Hello, this time on SITREP, after sending troops for Russia's war with Ukraine, North Korea has now ratified a mutual defense treaty with Moscow.
The deepening military cooperation between Russia and North Korea is a threat to both the Indo-Pacific and Euro-Atlantic security.
That is the verdict of the new NATO Secretary General. We'll assess that view and what's in it for Russia and North Korea with Joseph Dempsey, who spent years uncovering secrets of North Korea's military capability. On the Korean Peninsula itself, there have been big missile tests, GPS jamming, and shots fired across the demilitarized zone. Lieutenant General Andrew Harrison, who spent 2 years helping enforce the armistice, gives us his assessment of the tensions there.
There's always this watchful wariness that you're only one miscalculation or one accident or one deliberate act by the North away from something catastrophic.
And in the skies above China, Beijing's new J-35 stealth fighter makes its debut. Apart from one letter, how does it compare to its US counterpart?
SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
First, it was sending ammunition, then troops. Now North Korea has signed off on a formal mutual defense treaty with Russia. Mike, how big a deal is this?
Well, the treaty itself is very expansive in its wording, including, I noticed it said that they're working towards a just and multipolar new world order, which is part of the ambition. But in reality, it comes down to how they can help each other in a very transactional way. So the North Koreans are certainly helping Russia with the war in Ukraine, supplying them with about 2 million artillery shells. And Russia is assumed to be helping the North Koreans with their nuclear and missile development. And there's other elements as well. So the treaty itself looks very extensive. The reality is down to a few particular things that they genuinely want to exchange.
Well, let's bring in Joseph Dempsey, Research Associate for Defence and Military Analysis at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Joseph, good to see you on SITREP. Thank you for your time. How much do we actually know about the detail of this mutual defence treaty then?
Not a huge amount in terms of what it will actually involve in practice. We know the theory, as Michael's kind of outlined. I think the timing is very interesting, particularly with the countries. Although it was signed earlier this year, they'd both ratified it within a week of each other in the last month. And this obviously coincides with the arrival of at least 10,000 North Korean troops in Russia, some of which have already been deployed to the Kursk region. So in their sense, this will legitimize that deployment because it under mutual defense pact, where they can defend each other.
Mike, Moscow and Pyongyang would argue a simple agreement to come to each other's aid if required is no threat to anyone else. It's just like the bilateral relationships many other countries have, including, for example, the UK and the US.
Yeah, but if it was a relationship to come to each other's aid if they were attacked, then that would be more understandable. But this is to come to each other's mutual aid if they want to, if they think it's necessary. And if you're going to attack your neighbours, then you have a rather different view of what is self-defence. So the treaty, I think, has to be interpreted in an aggressive way, as far as we're concerned, however it is actually written.
Joseph, can we just take a step back and look at North Korea's conventional military power? More than a million troops, thousands of tanks and artillery guns, but you need more than numbers to make capability. How capable are the forces they're offering into this treaty?
Well, I think the main, it's difficult to say, really. So obviously, North Korea has a large conventional force, but it is, on the whole, woefully obsolete, largely based on various old Soviet and Chinese legacy systems. And that is a large part of why they have obviously invested heavily into developing a nuclear capability, of course. In terms of what they can add to the Russian dimension and the war in Ukraine, well, I think obviously they've given a lot of munitions over the last 2 years, and we've seen that increase to ballistic missiles. And they have huge surplus and stocks of Soviet-era munitions and artillery shells, so it makes sense that Russia would go to them. It's probably the second largest outside of Russia, or was. Ballistic missiles may not be as capable as the Russian ones, but they can supply them in plentiful numbers potentially, and it's an extra supply chain, and Russia's been running very low on those over the years of the conflict. But I think realistically, it's the manpower in this latest dimension that we've seen now, and they've committed 10,000 troops. Now, that doesn't seem a huge number, It obviously a lot of people, but it doesn't seem a huge number in terms of what you see what Russia's contributing. It doesn't see a huge amount in terms of what Russia is also losing. The attrition rate is quite high. And there's already reportedly around 50,000 troops in the Kursk region already fighting Ukrainian forces. So it's interesting to see how North Korean troops and where North Korean troops will be used in this conflict. We only know about Kursk, and this is an arguably part of the legitimacy of fighting mutual defense because that is Russian recognized territory. So it could be limited to there. Whether they actually go into what we internationally recognize as Ukraine territory at some point is hard to say. But it could allow Russia to free up troops from the Kursk region onto other fronts.
And Joseph, how much concern do you think this treaty is provoking at NATO HQ and in the MOD? Does it force updates to their military planning?
Well, yes, obviously it's providing Russia with more force, more manpower. It's also going to prolong the war. It may not necessarily change the outcome of it, but it's certainly going to keep Russia being able to push Ukraine. And obviously Ukraine has other concerns as well with the US elections and about long-term support.
Mike, we see what Russia, and we just talked about Russia, is already getting from this tight relationship, troops for its war in Ukraine to go with the ammunition we believe is already receiving. Is there a longer-term benefit for Russia?
Well, there may turn out to be. I think the North Korean troops that are now fighting in Kursk, by the look of it, I think that's very much an experiment to see how they get on, to see what the issues are. And it may well be that there could be a lot more in due course, because the assumption is that Russia's war on Ukraine is a very long-term thing. Whatever happens next year, the Russians are committed to eradicating Ukraine as an independent state. And the Russians may find that they have a longer-term need for foreign troops because their own mobilization is plateauing out next year. And so this 10,000 may turn out, to be the beginning of a bigger commitment of permanent or semi-permanent North Koreans troops rotating in and out of Russia to fight the wars that Putin seems to want to fight around the fringes of Europe.
And Joseph, the assumption is that by many people that it's the making of nuclear weapons technology that North Korea might get out of it. Is this the limits of it, or does it go much further than that?
Obviously, we don't know the details. And whilst we have a much greater visibility of what Russia is getting out of it now, and that's evolving, obviously, there's very little information about what North Korea has already got over the last 2 years and will get in the future. Yes, obviously, the nuclear program is a big concern. But I think, you know, North Korea has made some big strides already. And I think, you know, most countries will now accept it as, you know, a nascent nuclear power. I think there's other aspects, more in terms of delivery systems, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles. They would still benefit from Russian assistance. But also there's a plethora of conventional capabilities North Korea has been working on for many years. We're seeing some of that being developed and put out there that would really benefit from Russian assistance. Now, what form that will take and how visible that will be in a lot of cases will be interesting to see. It's also very unclear, you know, what Russia is willing to give up, particularly in terms of things like the crown jewels of its technologies.
Mike, it's all making the UN and its sanctions look powerless, isn't it?
Yeah, it does. And because remember, all this help to North Korea is breaking UN sanctions, which have been in place for many, many years. And Russia began to break those sanctions when it did its first deal with North Korea to supply artillery shells. And as Joseph said, I mean, North Korea's got so many shells, a lot of them are duds, up to a third of them were duds, but that doesn't matter. They were supplying military equipment to Russia. Putin, and for that matter, the Chinese, have just decided the UN resolutions really don't matter in this respect. And I'm afraid that, you know, you look at Chinese operations in the UN, they've bought the UN in many other respects. So they've bought their way onto most of the committees. They've dominated the discussions at the UN. So there's certain things you can't talk about. You can't talk about the Uyghur peoples, for instance, you know, whom the Chinese are practicing effective genocide against in Xinjiang province. You simply can't say it in any area of the UN, not in any committee, not in any document. You simply can't say it because the Chinese have got such a hold on the UN now that they just close it down. Can't be done. And so in that respect, the UN is being really undermined. And this is just another aspect of the basic undermining of the whole organization, sadly.
And Joseph, of course, one of the things North Korea is getting is a different experience on the ground for its troops right now. I just wonder where this Russia-North Korea tie-up leads next.
It's a good question. I very much agree with Michael's point that this is, you know, a proof of concept. 10,000 troops is not a huge amount in the big scheme of things, particularly when you've taken size of the conflict, but also North Korean manpower. So it could be a proof of concept in terms of seeing how well these troops cope with the environment, how well they fit into the organization of Russian structure, and obviously the natural language barriers here, certain to consider, differences in equipment, and how it all work out. So we don't know how many more thousands of troops will be going through. The interesting question is, if we're talking tens of thousands potentially, we're also going to see an awful lot of casualties, potentially on the North Korean side, depending on where they're deployed and how they're deployed. And that raises some interesting questions at home for North Korea as well. How they're going to control that narrative, particularly when families are not getting their loved ones back. Now, North Korea has a very closed state media system, so as far as where they've not said anything particularly beyond the pact about any Russian involvement in the Ukraine war directly. So it'll be interesting to see how that changes and if it needs to change or whether that be challenged.
Really interesting to have your thoughts. Joseph Dempsey, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Mike, let's just chat a little bit more about the North Korean deployment of 10,000 troops to Russia. It looks like they're going to be used in an attempt to recapture the Kursk region invaded by Ukraine. What is the picture on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, I think partly because of the Trump election and the idea that we might now be looking at some sort of imposed ceasefire on Ukraine early next year, the Russians look as if they're making a big effort now to grab Kursk back, the whole of the province. I mean, Putin originally said he wanted it back by the 1st of October, and that didn't happen. But, I mean, the Russians have now got a big incentive to try to recover Kursk so that they don't have to trade it away in negotiations, let's say, in late January or February or March. And they've put more troops into it, including they've thrown the North Koreans in, I think, probably before they intended to. And the Ukrainians they control about half the territory that they originally took, but they're fighting fiercely. I mean, I think the Ukrainians will withdraw because they always intended that. They've got quite small flanks, so they can get back into their own side of the border quite quickly. But I think they'll want to hang on as long as they can. And the real Battle of Kursk is now underway. It's ferocious. What's happening to the west of the incursion as it now stands.
And Mike, how likely do you think it is that the North Korean troops might push into Ukraine?
I think it's entirely likely. For the rest of the world, that would be another big step. Instead of actually helping the Russians to defend their own territory, to move into somebody else's territory. However, from Putin's point of view, that's all Russian territory. He assumes that five provinces of Ukraine are already Russian, even though he doesn't control them. And so from his point of view, having North Koreans fight in Luhansk and Donetsk is the same as having them fight in Kursk. It won't look the way to the rest of the world, however. And even the North Koreans might think twice about that, but I don't think Putin will be too bothered when it comes to it.
Now, the tie-up between Russia and North Korea has put military actions and tensions on the Korean Peninsula itself back in the spotlight. The North just test-fired an intercontinental ballistic missile for the first time in nearly a year, reaching higher and further than ever seen before. It's reported to have fired several short-range ballistic missiles into the sea and then staged GPS jamming attacks against South Korean ships and aircraft. South Korea has also fired a ballistic missile into the sea in its own show of force, while a US nuclear-capable B-1B bomber joined air drills along with Japan. Not quite in the middle of it all is United Nations Command South Korea, an American-led multinational force tasked with upholding the armistice. Retired Lieutenant General Andrew Harrison was its deputy commander through 2022 and 2023.
Probably since 1953, the mood has always been we're on the cusp of something very dangerous all the time. And so there is certainly from the American and UN's United Nations command perspective, the nearly 30 countries involved over there, there's always this watchful wariness that you're only one miscalculation or one accident or one deliberate act by the North away from something catastrophic. So there's always this sense of foreboding about the situation there, which is surreal when you walk around a city like Seoul, you know, this huge multi-million population that live in one of the most advanced cities in the world, where life almost goes on irrespective of what's happening in the border so close to the North.
Are you saying then the situation on the ground, as people are telling you, feels the same or as risky as normal? There's no detection of any kind of feeling of escalation at all?
It comes and goes. So it's there are always spikes, and these grow to high levels of real concern to periods of calm. But it just feels like since the closer interaction between DPRK and Russia, the challenges over there have reached global interest. And I think the world is therefore starting to take a lot more interest. So in South Korea, they're very used to these increased tensions, these provocations. And whilst the overt warnings that were played over loudspeakers across Seoul almost a year ago, were a shock to the people, I think actually in South Korea, they just live with this day in, day out, and hope that the warnings don't actually manifest themselves into some serious breakdown in the armistice.
The missile test, the GPS jamming, shows of force in the air are all outside the UN command's primary responsibility, the demilitarized zone between North and South. But will they have impacted on that job at all?
Yeah, I think the campaign for the UNC and the way the UNC is responsible for the maintenance of the armistice has subtly changed over the years. And Kim Jong-un and the forces from the North have moved away from the sort of ground incursions, which were very much the sort of rule of thumb for many decades, and are now using what we might call gray zone warfare, or, you know, cyber and space and other, obviously the ballistic missile testing, obviously lots of other ways rather than simply troops moving on the ground in that sort of binary fashion that used to happen. And UNC are wrestling with these challenges about how they deal with that. It's problematic, and it's not just UNC, of course, the Americans and the Republic of Korea forces are having to deal with this in exactly the same fashion.
We also saw last month the North blow up roads on their side, albeit only symbolically. They're still connected to the two Koreas. South Korea's military says it fired warning shots in response. Is that the kind of event that would have drawn in the UN command?
Yeah, anything that happens in the demilitarized zone, it directly impacts the area of responsibility of the United Nations command. And the blowing up of roads is indicative of this sort of change, which really has been signposted since the change of the North Korea's constitution, where they're no longer overtly seeking unification. I think that chapter has gone. And I think Kim Jong-un, by blowing up these roads, is sending a very clear and obvious signal that actually it's no longer from the North's perspective about unification on North Korea's terms. It's more the formalization of South Korea as an adversary against North Korea. And that's a subtle but really important change in Kim Jong-un's perspective, would be my judgment.
That's really interesting. And the mutual defense pact between North Korea and Russia now, if that led to Russian troops on the peninsula, what effect could that have?
Yeah, again, it's indicative of this shift, this regionalization of the conflict. I mean, it used to be really till probably only a year or two ago that DPRK's activity were very independent, even from China. We always knew there were links between China in terms of missile technology and North Korea. But Russia's formalization, the Mutual Defense Pact, the visits, the troop movements, the transfer of high-end technologies is a sign that the forces of North Korea are now working in a regional context.
And at that point, as to whether or not Russian troops may one day end up on the peninsula, would it raise the risk of miscalculation? Could it be a red line for Seoul?
Yeah, I mean, whether it's a red line for Seoul will be Seoul's decision. So I can't really talk to that point. I mean, undoubtedly, by having another major player, China, Russia, and North Korea operating, or if they were operating in North Korea, that increases the complexity. And of course, one's got to remember that the whole reason that the last stages of the Korean War in 1953 happened, history tells us it was because America got so close to China. And so you can see historically, if there's Russian troops abutted to American troops and Republican Korea troops on the border, then that must increase the risk of regional increases in regional tension. So I worry the complexity is dangerous.
You told us last time that there had been a couple of times in your tenure when you were seriously asked yourself, are we going to war? Would you be thinking that right now if you were still there?
It's difficult to say because distance gives you a perspective because you're not inculcated with the, you know, all the news all the time. And clearly I don't have access to all the top secret stuff that is going on. But I think I would be certain that people are ready for something happening all the time, both in the North and the South.
Just on a personal note, now that you're away from it and you're out of that particular role, I remember last time we spoke, you talked about losing sleep, about the tensions there. How do you view it with a bit of distance now, your time there?
I always wish that people could give it the focus I think it deserves. But of course, probably any officer any stationed anywhere around the world would have that view about their patch. But I do think the more we understand it, the more we understand the links that are going on between Russia and DPRK and, you know, China's perspective as well, the better we can understand those, the less chance there is of something breaking down. It is important to remember that the US and China are very, very close in South Korea. DPRK is on, as I describe it, this hair trigger all the time. And now Russia is heavily involved. So it is something that we in the UK, I think, must keep a constant eye on, along with obviously all the other major flashpoints around the world. But I think this one is not well understood in the UK.
General Harrison, it's been so good speaking to you. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
No problem. Thank you very much, Kate.
Mike, with everything happening in Ukraine and the Middle East, there's a danger our eyes off the ball on the Korean Peninsula, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And, you know, it's a sad fact that when global security begins to break down, it begins to break down everywhere because one area has a knock-on effect to another. And the fact is the South Koreans are now very worried by what's happening in the North, not just the North Korean-Russian tie-up that we've talked about, but also the fact that the North is visibly more aggressive in everything that it's looking at. And South Korea is beginning to turn its attention much more to how it's going to deal with the North. Instead of détente with the North, how can it deter the North more convincingly? Japan is the same. The Japanese are now much more worried about North Korea than they were. I was talking to a very good Japanese journalist just last week, and he was saying that they really are fixated now in Tokyo on what North Korea is going to do next. So it's not all about United States and North Korea. It's also about North Korea in the region. And don't forget, too, that China is not always happy about this because, you know, North Korea is beginning to become a bigger problem to them in terms of its capacity for instability and creating instability than it was before. So the Chinese have some sort of interest in damping all this down, but in a way, they find that quite difficult.
And if it were to come to actual conflict between the two Koreas, we know the US is tied in. Would the UK be part of it?
Well, in theory it is, because the armistice of 1953, which created or legitimized North and South Korea, the armistice after the Korean War, was between the United Nations Command and the North Korean Army. That was the armistice was signed between those two groups. And of course, Britain is part of the United Nations Command. So in that respect, we are one of the parties to the 1953 arrangement, which might break down. So yes, in theory, we would be obligated. In practice, I guess we would, diplomatically, we'd certainly line up behind the United States. And I suppose militarily, if there was something we could usefully contribute, then we would. But I think I can promise you it's not a planning assumption within the MOD that we have to have forces, naval forces, or still less ground or air forces, that would somehow operate in that part of Asia in the event of a Korean War or a resumption of the Korean War itself. If we could, we would help. But if we can't, and we probably won't be able to, then it would be diplomatic only, I suspect.
Mike, you mentioned China a moment ago. Let's go there now. Beijing has been showing off its new J-35A stealth fighter jet at China's largest air show in the city of Zhuhai. It's designed to rival the F-35 flown by the US and a myriad of its allies, including the UK. BFBS Forces News reporter Claire Sadler has been taking a look. Claire, hi. Aside from the remarkably similar name and, to my eye, quite a similar shape, how does the J-35A stack up against the F-35?
Yeah, lots of excitement around the debut of this aircraft because, like any of these big projects, of course, it's been years in the making. And as you say, designed as the challenger to the F-35 in terms of stealth and performance, but we don't really have a huge amount of detail about it. Although at first glance, as you say, it does look very similar. We know the engines are different. The J-35 is a twin engine jet. The F-35 has one engine. The F-35 is thought to have perhaps more advanced stealth coatings and a lower radar cross-section than the J-35, but we don't actually know anything about its radar-absorbing materials. And in relation to takeoff, this is another area of difference. The J-35 requires a catapult for takeoff, which the F-35s don't. But the fact that the J-35 has that short takeoff and vertical landing design actually makes it less sleek in design than the J-35. And of course, when it comes to cost, $80 to $100 million or something like that for an F-35, J-35, that's expected to be cheaper thanks to China's lower manufacturing costs. So in conclusion, we just don't really know a huge amount of details about it. But this is what Dr. Jacob Parakilas, who's a research leader in the defense and security team at RAND Europe, told me.
In terms of the design, I mean, certainly there are, I think, elements of industrial espionage, but also stealth aircraft with a certain set of mission parameters, given the state of technology, are going to converge on a similar set of design characteristics. So there are certainly some reasons to be suspicious that there might be, let's say, inspirations or direct lifts from Western technology in the J-35, but also when you look at the design of stealth aircraft that have come out, fifth generation aircraft that have come out, the Su-57, the Turkish Khan, the Korean KFX, the F-35, the F-22, they all have a broadly similar appearance because what you need to do to create an aircraft which is supersonic, carries a useful load of weapons internally, is low observable, and can be used in all weathers and potentially from the deck of an aircraft carrier, you're going to end up, given the state of technology, with a pretty similar overall shape.
And Claire, do we know if it's actually ready to operate?
Well, my understanding is probably not yet. It's still in that testing and development stage. But speaking to Dr. Parakilas about this, he was saying that Russia certainly and probably China have very different cycles between design, prototyping and testing. And they tend to trust their prototypes at an earlier stage than Western countries. No sign, though, that it's been used on any operations yet. But we just really don't know how long that's going to be.
And there's also a carrier-based variant, isn't there?
Yeah, that's true. So you've got the J-35A, that's the land-based version, and then you have the J-35, which is the carrier-based version. The land-based version, largely thought to be for export, but it's thought now that the PLA Air Force is likely to get it to work alongside its J-20, and that will or does make China the only the second country to operate two types of stealth fighter, the other of course being the US, which has the F-35 and the F-22. The differences between the land-based and carrier version, well, people are sort of speculating a little bit, but it's thought the land-based probably has a smaller wing surface area and larger landing gear.
Mike, China's trying to up its air power. How does it compare right now?
Well, it's determined to match US designs. And as we said, I mean, there's a lot of industrial espionage suspected about this aircraft, the J-35A. And, you know, in 2015, Edward Snowden, all the papers that came out over the Snowden revelations, some of them indicated fairly definitively, if you can believe them, that a lot of stealth technology had been stolen by China at that stage for its aircraft development. And what the Chinese are certainly trying to do is to create, you know, A2AD, as it's called, which is anti-access area denial. So they don't have to be as good as the United States, but they have to be good enough in their own area to make it too risky for the American Air Force to operate. And they aim to do that both in the air and at sea, which is why they're developing carrier power projection capabilities, and why this aircraft, you know, whenever it gets to operate, however good it turns out to be, is obviously designed for the carriers. I mean, the Chinese are developing three carriers. They'll not before too long, they'll have five. They intend to have a carrier force which can make it too risky for the United States to get very close to the Chinese mainland in the Western Pacific.
And Claire, Russia's Su-57 has also taken part in the show.
Yes, it's the first time it's been at the air show. The Kremlin calls it the most advanced fifth-generation stealth fighter, but there has been a mixed reaction to it across social media. Many people not really very impressed, saying the sections didn't seem to line up properly, and it raised questions about the real technological level of aircraft construction in Russia. But there's also talk that this was a prototype that was at the air show, and some really are pointing to that. But yes, again, lots of excitement around that too.
And Mike, we've been talking about the increased military ties between Russia and North Korea. What's the direction of travel in terms of Russia-China military ties?
Yeah, I mean, there's a complete reversal there compared to, say, 20 or 30 years ago, where China was very much the junior partner in terms of its military capability. It had a big military, but it wasn't very sophisticated. And Russia had a pretty sophisticated military because of the Cold War and the dynamics of all of that. And the whole thing is now turned around, that the Chinese look as if they will have a very sophisticated military machine. Russia's military machine will still be pretty good, but it will be a long way behind China's. And so the direction of cooperation is now the other way around. The Russians need Chinese help, not just with the war in Ukraine, but they need, as it were, Chinese momentum behind the sort of military policy which both Russia and China want to exert on the Western powers in the 2030s. And both Russia and China are on course to be some way ahead of the Western powers by the mid-2030s. Whether they'll make it, whether the West will respond, we don't know. But on present trends, China and Russia will both be ahead of us technologically by the mid-30s.
And Claire, what other new kit is on show?
Quite a few bits of kit, actually. Sticking with the aircraft, there's the J-15D, that's known as the Flying Shark, an electronic warfare variant of the J-15 carrier-based fighter jet designed to carry out electronic attack and electronic countermeasure missions. And then there's the killer whale, or the Orca. It's not all about the air. This is one of China's growing fleet of unmanned ships. And if you have a look at the pictures of it, it's really quite impressive. So 58-metre vessels, got about 4,000 nautical mile range. And it's apparently capable of carrying a whole arsenal of weapons, and is designed for patrolling, anti-submarine warfare, air defence and rescue operations. I mean, there are, I think, 750 exhibitors from 40 countries at this air show. So lots of opportunity for these companies to sell their wares and to highlight their capabilities. And one of those was the SH-16A howitzer, primarily designed for export by China, again, to countries who are looking for affordable, modern, self-propelled artillery solutions. So not as expensive as the West, perhaps not quite as good, but up there.
Really interesting, Claire. Thank you very much for that overview. Mike, a final thought. It's not just China, Russia and North Korea. The US, the UK and other Western allies are all investing big in military hardware. The world's biggest military powers look to be locked in a high-tech arms race right now. Is there an inevitability that this kit gets used in real anger at some point?
Well, that's what it's designed for. It's all designed to be operational. And in a way, we're back in the situation in analogy terms of the 1950s, where the powers were competing with each other in a real arms race in every respect. And then after the shock of the Cuban Missile Crisis, we began to move to arms control. So we began to sort of plateau out our developments in a way that kept a balance and a general sense of predictability. Now, all that arms control has disappeared. We're back in a world where almost every aspect of arms control has now been broken or has gone or has just faded away. And so we're back in a kind of a 1950s mentality where we are furiously arms racing each other now between East and West and within the West and within the East, or within the competitor, the autocratic powers. One hopes that we'll get back to arms control without the shock of a new Cuba crisis or something comparable to actually make us wake up to the dangers, but we'll see.
A sobering thought to end on. Mike, thank you so much. And thanks to all of our guests. That is all for now. But the new episode of Mike's podcast, Great British Battle Commanders, is online now. This time discussing Boudicca, the warrior queen. We'll be back with another sit rep next Thursday. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.